It is a pleasure to be with you, and I must say I've been intimidated as all get out when I didn't succeed at refusing. Margaret Singel's invitation, and then I thought we were supposed to be, because the right hand of the brain and the left hand of the brain, one takes creativity and artistry and sorting through, and one takes direction. And while I was trying to figure out how to sort through the Reformation, the direction part of my brain got lost. So I thought we were at Trinity Episcopal today. Not that I wasn't told. So I have a boo-boo on one of these things, because in my thinking, you were there. I ask your patience in that regard. I want to thank Elizabeth and Dale and Tom and you, old inviter, for your invitation to be here. I am not a Reformation scholar, though I am a DNA Lutheran. I have always been a Lutheran. And when you jump into the pool of Reformation history, you find there's a lot you can't talk about, because there's not a long enough life. So I've made some random decisions, and just as Martin Luther really was not a systematic theologian, me too, not systematic theologian. But I want to begin these reflections by saying there's some things about Martin Luther's teaching that have carried through for me that I use pretty regularly, and there's lots that I don't use. Things like that breakthrough understanding of simul justus et peccator, same time, saint and sinner. Not saint up here and sinner down here, not saint here and sinner there, not saint sometimes and sinner other times. No, in the same simul, in the same moment, saint and sinner. There was an Enneagram study that helped me kind of get a different point of view on that, though I had loved it all along. Because it accepts both our shadow, the part of ourselves we'd like not to be related to, and our bright side, the part we'd like to be, or sometimes think we are. And the Enneagram talks about levels of awakeness, being awake or asleep, and that we're still the same person. We haven't stopped being that person, whether we're awake or asleep. Well, Luther was on to something, and we'll come past some of that as we review some of his story. But simul justus et peccator is still fresh language. It is still a new concept. We still want to divide ourselves into camps and say either or. So that's one of his big carry forwards for me.
Could you write those words on the board, simul?
I knew you were there. The same time justified or saint, made right, and sinner. A second thing about Luther is he is so earthy. There is really no cleaning up his language, except if you don't read German, then you can clean it up. But his illustrations, his sense of being one with the land and with the street and with the people and with the frustration, gives him very vivid, earthy, not ethereal images precisely, but his feet on the ground. So one of his understandings about what he came to know as law and gospel is he said that people return to the law the way a dog returns to his vomit. Pretty graphic, huh? Yeah, you know, he had a dog named Klutz, I think. And he looked at his dog, and his dog was one of his spiritual directors. If I could have the faith of my dog sitting by the table looking up at me patiently waiting for something to come, I would be faithful. Fido, fidelity, right? Another phrase that has been so important to me is his description of sin. And he said, you take a dry leaf, and when a leaf dries, it curls in on itself, right? In curvatus in se. Sin is curling in on itself. The process of being dying. The process of dying. So sin is that which curls us in on ourselves. In Verbatus in say. I hope you don't want me to put that up there. Thank you, Anne. I'm so grateful. In Verbatus in say. Curb in on ourselves. When we talk about law and gospel, it's only been recently that I came to understand that the Ten Commandments, for example, we point to that as the law. Depending on who's hearing it and when you're hearing it, it can sound like gospel to you. But the law isn't the law because it says, do not do this. The law is the law because it's what arrives on us. So that the words of grace can feel sort of legal to us, depending on how we're hearing it or reading it, that words of law can seem liberating and therefore gracious. So we can't just say the Torah is the law and the gospel is grace. Within the gospel are moments that gather us up, let us see ourselves clearly, cause us to grieve, condemn us, the heart condemns, or gathers up all the ways we've missed the mark and sets us free. But so can the law speak to that same place. So we got to mix it up a little bit. But in certain language, you could say the ego always wants to go towards the law. That good order, that this is the way you do it. And then lectures you with a whole committee on the inside about how you or they, either way, maybe it wasn't the law condemning you, but they aren't doing it right. So it's equal opportunity. See, we use the Zepicotter, law and gospel, in Kerbakus and say. Then, when I was in seminary and reading his explanation in the Large Catechism, his teaching manual for priests and scholars, in his explanation to the First Commandment, I am the Lord your God. He said, that to which your heart clings and entrusts itself is your God. That to which your heart clings and entrusts itself is your God. And I thought, what a broad, still fresh understanding of God. Whatever we are clinging to, whatever we're trusting in, and usually the second runner-up, or sometimes the first, is mammon, is the money stuff. That's one of the big competitors with that to which our heart clings and entrusts itself. So he got it. He also understood, and we'll come to it a little bit later, that he spent much of his life and time hating God. His spiritual director told him so, and he kind of believed it and saw it and wrote from that sense of this loathing. And that if we could keep all the other commandments, we just couldn't keep that first one. And that was the thing that caused us all the breakage, all the harm, all of the hurt, that we just didn't have the capacity to trust in God. And so that, I am the Lord your God, you shall have no other gods, he said, that's the conundrum, that's the knot. If we could put the God of liberation, the God of Exodus, the God who returns us home from exile, if we could really put our heart and our trust to that God, we would be receiving all of the graces of God that God is pouring out all the time. But that's the stumbling block. That's the thing that we fall on. So I thought I would do the requisite musical event at the beginning. Tom, or maybe I can just push it and see if we've got it. Thank you. excited for you is we're over it. That robust hymn is just one of, oh my goodness, how many hymns did he write over his lifetime? But that, a mighty fortress is our God. One of the realities with Martin Luther was both the times that he lived in, and I'm going to spend quite a bit of time now kind of giving us background, and the brilliance that was his, and what was going on in the world, that he matched and challenged what were his limits and what are the things that last beyond that time. One of the other things, besides the ones I've listed so far, that are important about Luther, he understood the theology of the cross and the theology of glory. And he said the theology of glory isn't going to get us very far. It's going to catch us up in our schemes. The theology of Christ, Christ crucified, Christ raised, the mystery of our faith, Christ has died, Christ has risen, Christ will come again. That's where he was going to hang his hat and his life and his future. But even today, we're still dealing with that dichotomy. The theology of glory has so much in it that people want to promote. And people want to, you know, build up on that side of the story without reckoning with the cross. And so he stands, and the Reformation tradition stands in the theology of the cross. Another breakthrough, and was referred to earlier, I think, is the priesthood of all believers. Now, at some point, depending on how long this goes, I hope to take a look at the impact of Luther marrying Katie, 16 years his junior. What is it to have a reformer, the first reformer who will die a natural death? What is it to have a reformer be married with children? Do laundry at home. You know, decide whose turn is it to get up with the kid in the middle of the night. To be a grieving father when two daughters die. What changes the doing and the living of theology when that's part of the experience? I want to just put a footnote ahead of time and to say one of the great sorrows of Luther's, of the inheritance of Luther, is that at the end of his life he was embittered about many things, and certainly his writing about the Jews had caused no end of harm. And a decade or so ago, the ELCA recanted that part of Luther's writings and spoke publicly words of apology and sorrow and grief, and I think those words and that activity and that statement are in Holocaust museums around the world, so that we can notice that not all of this powerful man yielded what was good, and that we have the capacity to sorrow over how what he wrote and said, even at the time his friends wanting him to shut up about it already, you know, but he was so disappointed. He was disappointed that the people he thought, simply if we reformed ourselves, would be attracted to us, weren't. And that the Reformation itself was running out of control, out of his hands, and it wasn't going the way he wanted. And then he had a lot of physical problems as well. So at the end of his life, he wasn't much fun to be around. But he still managed to write some hymns. And he still managed to give us some closing words that are worth keeping. So some background. You know that Lutherans teach pretty consistently that we're saved by grace and not by works. And so there's a story we tell on ourselves about an old Lutheran farmer who on his deathbed was visited by his pastor, and he said, "Pastor, I am so sure I am going to heaven." "Why, John, why are you so sure you are going to heaven? I have not done a single good work in my entire life." There are some ways we can misunderstand the teaching. Because Martin Luther's understanding is that God doesn't need our works, but our neighbor does. And that's that's the flow. And that's the difference. If you do good work, you get a better bunk in heaven, is not the version he was working for. God has given all out of love for you. Therefore, that love flows to neighbor. That, it comes up in his sacramental theology, in his worship, in his hymns, in his teaching. Now, 1483, time capsule. It was on St. Martin's Eve, November 10th. He is the second son to Hans and Margaret Luther. I just happen to have a scary picture of his parents. You want that for dad?
I'm
father-in-law. Yeah. That's right. And he said, Jude, about cake, you know, this was not exactly the, what you call it, that trophy bride?
Yeah.
We don't know about that, but...
She looks just like
Mother Teresa. Yeah. maybe there's a family story there. On St. Martin's Eve, 1483, his second son, born to Hans and Margaret. They live in a mining town of Eisleben in Saxony. How many have been to Germany and have traveled in that area? And, yeah. That comes to mind. I haven't ever been to Germany, actually. And in honor of the saint who had watched over this birthing event, they named him Martin. Well, you may know, I didn't know, that St. Martin is the patron of drinking and merriment. On the eve of November 11th, I commission you, drink and be merry, and remember Martin Luther. It also was like a solstice. It also marked the passing from autumn to winter. So that was his birth time. If saints and medieval demons were watching over this child, this son of a Saxon peasant couple would himself watch over a whole new era. And he would help bring it into being. He didn't set out for that, but he had a lot of credentials. The dark and haunted world into which Luther was born was on the point of turning. You've probably read Phyllis Tickle's wonderful book, The Great Emergence, and she quotes the bishop who says every 500 years or so the church has a big rummage sale. Yeah. So I love that image. A new spirit was emerging at that point out of the gloom of the late Middle Ages. Some folks were beginning to rebel against the old superstitions and the fears that controlled the people. Some scholars were beginning to re-examine all kinds of beliefs about the world. In 1483, towns were beginning to stir with commerce. Mines were becoming big employers. Printing press had gotten itself well established. Paper was being manufactured. Literacy was expanding. More than just the scholars were getting texts. German universities were proliferating. In Italy, across the Alps, the Renaissance had already brought forward awareness of the pleasures of the earth, not just the hope and promise of some future paradise. So beyond the Rhine, France and England had ceased hostilities. In Portugal, Christopher Columbus, you know, 1483, 1492, I wonder if the word came to the young 9-year-old boy to Christopher Columbus was trying to enlist support from a skeptical court for a plan to reach the wealth of Asia by taking a route across the ocean. 30 years before Luther's birth, Constantinople. For over 1,000 years, a Christian stronghold in the East had fallen to the Turks. One effect of that change of power was the fleeing of many Greek scholars across the borders, refugees, flooding southern Europe, bringing a heritage of scholarship, antiquity, and an intellectual training. And it didn't take long before their scholarly attention turned to the existing New Testament, and they found the discrepancies between the Vulgate of St. Jerome and the Greek text, and began to work with translation again. St. Jerome is recorded as saying that the translator is a traitor. because there's always a call. There's always an interpretive call. There's always a filter that between three or four meanings of a word and nuanced phrases, you're going to make a call. Well, one of the calls was John the Baptist saying, "Do penance." But that wasn't what John the Baptist was saying. He was saying, "Metanoia, repent, change your mind, turn around and go in a different direction. Hey, penance, do penance." That was not the meaning of the word. So with the world expanding, inner worlds and outer worlds, literature, art, scholarship, business, a sense of who human beings were also affected. What is the place of the human in the world? These get a foot in the door. By 1500, Europe possessed 9 million books, an estimate. 1500, Europe possessed an estimated 9 million books. That was compared with fewer than 100,000 handmade manuscripts just 50 years before. Wow. Yeah. And people were reading, so the literacy rates were going up. It wasn't just that we could print them, we could read them. No other invention had so thoroughly or so rapidly revolutionized intellectual life. I wonder if they had Inquirer magazines at that time. The anti-intellectual reading. I think they did. I think they had their equivalent. No? The stirrings of independence, of autonomy, of freedom, of some spare change, time to think. These yield critiques, critiques of society, of culture, of patterns, of church. Well, it probably wasn't anywhere sharper a set of critiques, nor was independence more fiercely fought for than in Germany. Growing wealth of commerce, industry, expanding the influence of that burgher class. The Holy Roman Empire in Germany was not really a central state, but a religious political concept. And we know now that religion is never pure religion, is it? It's always commingled with the economy and with the politics and with the social culture. They're not apart from each other. That was here too. Roman by heritage, Christian by faith, primarily German by language and location, Germany was divided into 300 separate political units, both secular and ecclesiastical principalities. Who knows if we're not moving in that direction again in the disunited states? I'm not sure. Loyalty was owed to a prince or to a city government, not to the emperor. Emperor Frederick III had no real rule because no German emperor had succeeded in making a centralized state. So in Germany, not so much power, but authority, some influence. The princes and the towns restricted the emperor's power. But there were sources of power. There were 7 electors. These 7 electors were princes and archbishops, and they were ruling important territories. They were the ones who, in theory, elected the emperor. Semi-democratic. Saxony, where Luther was born and raised, was one of the larger principalities of the Holy Roman Empire. It had iron and copper mines. Luther's father had become an owner of mines and foundries. Less than a decade after Martin's birth, his father, Hans, hot-tempered, opinionated, a peasant, had gone about and acquired mines and foundries and became an official of the city. He was ambitious, and he was competent and forceful. He was shrewd and assertive, his father. And he held, as is not uncommon for parents, even greater ambition for his children, and particularly for Martin. You know that Martin was destined for the legal profession, so said his father, and you know something about the child-rearing rules of the day. They were pretty severe. Luther was obedient, oh, say for about 3 months. We don't know if the story of St. Anne's, the prayer to St. Anne saved me in that thunderstorm like we just had a few days ago, where a friend was killed, is that a true story, so it's told? There was a moment when something happened in that fearful heart and mind and soul, and that called the person, Martin Luther, where he said, I cannot do the legal profession. I'm becoming an Augustinian. There was weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth. And a big beer party before he went in. No matter how angry or demanding his father Hans was against the idea, Martin entered the monastery, the Augustinian cloister, when he was not yet 22 years old. I'm spending a lot of this morning just doing the background, because I think we see all of the themes that will just simply be aggravated or written out or explored and deepened right from the beginning. I just had a spiritual directee come up from Manhattan Beach, where I used to be, and we haven't talked for 7 years. And what was interesting is that some of the issues that she and I had talked about 12 years ago were still ringing through as true. It is to say, different names and dates, but some of the same themes. I think it's true for Luther, that what we're going to see him working on in these early years will be, and why we think they're rising up in him, will play themselves out in his writing, his teaching, his battles. Martin is a complicated human being. On the one hand, he's lively, he's cheerful, he's funny, he's particularly fond of music, song, singing, companionship, hale and hearty, well met. He loves his beer, it's one of his holy vices, he loves it. And on the other hand, Siebel, at the same time, he is stubborn, brooding, fearful of the wrath of God, given to tormenting introspection, self-inflicted punishment, all trying to find some confidence, some experience of spiritual grace, and he couldn't find by just showing up. The battles were too great. The habits of heart and mind just had him captured. It was when he listened to music that there would be some grace. The medieval ethos of God, a God of wrathful judgment, had full and complete hold on Luther. We glimpse here this experiential setting for that Simo Justus et Peccator. In his very body, he carries that truth. Later, Luther would write of his excessive drivenness in the practices in his religious community. And they were excessive and wore out his spiritual directors and his friends. He said, if ever a monk got to heaven by his monkery, I would have made it. All my brothers in the monastery will testify that had I gone on with it, I would have killed myself with vigils, prayers, reading and other work. End of quote. Even if his superiors found Luther's excesses exasperating, they were not blind to his genius. So they sent him to study and lecture at the new university in Wittenberg. Elector Frederick the Wise had chosen the shabby town of Wittenberg as the seat of his domain. He wished to make it a cultural center. He refurbished the town, he put in public buildings, a castle, a new church. He collected more than 17,000 old relics. He was a good businessman because he figured out that displaying them in the castle church would be good for tourism. Pilgrimages, they called them at the time. For viewing these relics, it had been declared that the faithful could gain indulgences, and the elector would gain income. It worked. 17,000 relics. The university was part of the plan. The University at Wittenberg was only 6 years old when Luther was sent there. He arrived in the winter of 1508. There were no more than 300 students at Wittenberg University at the time, but it was an aggressive university. It was open to novelty and change. There, Luther taught moral philosophy and Christian theology, but there was a mark on him that he had to continue to be a scholar. But this anguish, his anguish just kept working against him, even as his brilliant mind, his ability to translate, to know Greek and Hebrew and to work with the text. His confessor told him, Luther, God is not angry with you. It is you, Martin, you are angry with God. So that clue came forward by this insightful confessor. And indeed, the years unfolded, Martin Luther would write about human anger, about how we are inclined as much to hate God as not. It would inform his comprehension then when the greater grace arrived. After 2 years of study and lecturing, Luther accompanied a senior friar to Rome. He was not old yet. That was quite a trip. He would write about that eye-popping, revelatory trip for that young German boy. Out of Germany, he would not have missed the trip. He said, if I had missed, he would not have missed the trip. For then I might have been afraid of being unjust to the Pope. He saw it all. If piety didn't count for much in Rome at the time, money did. So it was counted in Rome as nearly everything. They were doing some interesting things with that money. Beautiful things with that money, in many cases. But the story is told that once while in Rome, Luther was saying the Mass. It was only a month-long visit, and he was saying the Mass, and there was an Italian priest who nudged him. Well, Luther was saying the Mass, and said, Pasta, get on, get on! Well, it turns out that the Italian priest would be able to say Mass 7 times faster than Luther. 7 masses in the time it took Luther to say one. Pasta. Every mass yielded a payment. A few months after the trip to Rome, the vicar general, Stauffit, called Luther to him and said this, you must become a doctor of teach me as it were. You must become a doctor and a preacher. Then you will have something to do. Well, Luther, like Moses saying, I don't want to go. I have bad speech patterns. I can't talk. I don't want to go. Luther had 15 excuses that he gave to stop it. 15 reasons. He said at the core, Luther was convinced that he still wanted to seek his salvation through isolated prayer. In the monastic life, the meditation in the monastic life, that little space that should contain him. He was afraid. Stauffit's rebuff, the resistance. Luther, don't you know that our Lord God has many great matters to attend to? For these, God needs clever people to advise him. If you should die as you fear after 3 months, you will be received into God's council in heaven, for God too has need of some doctors. Well, Stauffit said this in jest. He was earnest, and Luther gave up his resistance. He studied for his doctorate and lectured on Bible. No thought of causing upheaval, no thought to shake the church and to reshape the Christian world. But from the beginning, this brilliant, complicated, anguished, powerful, funny, earthy, music-loving, beer-loving young German man was a teacher out of the ordinary. One of the older professors at the university is reported to have exclaimed, sort of like a Simeon character, this monk will confuse all the doctors. He will start a new religion and reform the whole Roman church, where he bases his theology on the writings of the prophets and the apostles. He stands on the words of Christ. I don't know if that's just PR, if it was a real statement, but that was one they recorded. By 1512, so we're inching along. By 1512, Luther gets his doctorate. He's 29 years old. Over those 29 years, what's been going on? Well, Columbus finds support from Spain. He discovers the New World and the trade begins. The material world is becoming more and more defined. Spiritual ideas getting more confused. You've got the rational thinkers. You've still got full war superstition in the streets and with many people. You've got the humanist ideas. But it would be just 5 years later, 1517, where the 95 points, I've got the tiniest little print font type of the 95 points over there on that board. So if you wanted to read some of them, you can go and see what the mess was all about. 95 points for debate and discussion. It breaks open the conversation that is so right to break open. The whole universe that is his world is ready. So it's not just that Luther was in himself a brilliant man, but the times were ready. As I said earlier, there Luther was, when he died in 1546, would be the first reformer to die a natural death. There had been plenty of efforts to reform, courageous people speaking up. But money and power have a way. Something of Luther's uneasiness was everywhere in his world. So even though it was in his very body and mind and psyche, it was also in the culture that he was walking in. Something like the anxiety that's in the culture we're living in now. Don't you feel like you are back and drenched by anxiety and by extreme and anxious points of view that stop us from thinking creatively or sensibly? We catch it, we can see what it's like to catch anxiety. Well, it was worse then. But something new was breaking open. The world was primed. New maps were being drawn, literally. Discoveries of scholars and monks, as he studied in that quiet tower in Wittenberg, was part and parcel of beginning this thing called the Reform. The Reformation. A castle church door in Wittenberg may or may not have had the 95 ideas for debate pounded on them. There's debate about whether that's mythic, urban legend, or real. The 95 points are real. And what happened is that little form for debate just flew throughout the countryside. Just became the hot reading material of the day. The next Dan Brown mystery. The document spread and the rest is our history. Of the lasting effects of those momentous years of Luther's early formation and his lifetime, one of the most lovely outcomes, besides his theology or woven into his theology, at least in the minds and hearts of many of us, is in fact Luther's influence on congregational singing. It isn't just Garrison Keillor and Prairie Home Companion that talk about Lutherans loving to sing in four-part harmony. Luther's influence on congregational singing influenced all of our ways of worship. He wrote, "Music is an outstanding gift to God, and next to theology, I would not want to give up my slight knowledge of music for great considerations." He would keep the great ideas if he could, he would keep away from the great ideas if he could just keep the music. In a 1538 preface to a volume of liturgical music called Delightful Symphonies, he again said, "Next to the Word of God, music deserves highest praise." This point of view was new. It was not particularly supported by historical precedent. It came out of his love of music and his reading of the Old and New Testament. He said, "That it is good And God pleasing to sing hymns is, I think, known to every Christian, for everyone is aware of the example of the prophets and the kings of the Old Testament who praised God with sound, with song and sounds of poetry and psalter. Luther saw a core principle, a home verse in Psalm 96, verse 1. For the Hebrew people are encouraged to open their lips and to extol the wonder of God through their voices. Sing, says the psalmist, sing a new song for the Lord. Sing to the Lord, all the earth. Faith in the Lord, Luther concluded, happily finds proper outward expression through music and song. Music has a sacred character. And for Luther, it came also with healing balm. It came as an expressive gift from another part of his busy brain. Luther once remarked that the prophets practiced music more than any art and did not put their theology into geometry, arithmetic, or astronomy. I think he was making a case, and I'm on his side as an English major. They did not put their theology into geometry, arithmetic, or astronomy, but into music, intimately uniting theology and music, telling truth in psalms and songs. That's how he thought. Additionally, Luther pointed out that the revelation of Jesus Christ prompted the earliest Christians to break out in song and praise. In the realm of public education and development of faith, even before he had children, he knew the value of teaching using music. Luther put biblical teaching and doctrine to music, pulling in his experience of Latin hymnody and chant. He would give the older students catechetical teaching in Latin to songs to help them learn. Before young people are ordained into the ministry, he said, they should practice music in school. In contrast to the radical reformers of Zwingli and Carlstadt, Luther never took music as a worldly thing, but truly as a gift of God, which functioned within the church as a medium of the Spirit, whereby human hearts were moved to faith. So what I thought to do next is to sing several of Luther's texts, or his texts and tunes, to see what was the formative theology. However, I know we're at 11 o'clock.
Yes.
So I have this as my form of defense. I don't want you to ask me questions. Of theology or history, you can ask me, like, how old are my kids or something. What I'd like to do after the break is sing through the hymns. I'm going to take a fast trip to visit Katie and Martin and their relationship and try to avoid your questions.